So next on our agenda is we are to Gary Wunder, and he will be our keynote speaker. And you know Gary, we've talked with him all day. He's been a longtime Federationist and the editor of the Braille Monitor, which I've been reading myself for 40 some years. So welcome, Gary, to Delaware, and the floor is yours.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being here. I hope that I'm in visual focus. Checked my tie, combed my hair, put on my suit. Hopefully, I'm in visual focus. Anyway, I was thinking about banquet speeches, and recently I got a note from somebody that said, people like their banquet speeches short, and you should remember this when you start delivering your speeches because you always get more applause when you stop talking and sit down. So I told Kat that I would do my best to keep within her guidelines about how long banquet speeches should be. I won't tell you what she said. Most of you probably know my story if you've read the Braille Monitor. One of the first stories that appeared in the Braille Monitor that probably is the most well known about me is how at the age of two I learned to lie. It was also at the age of two that I learned what blind meant. Essentially, I went outside on a patio and I closed the door to the living room, a glass door, and there were a bunch of people in the living room, and I wanted to play by myself, and I went out on the patio and found glass bottles, and I noticed in playing with one that when I dropped it, it made a great noise, and I thought that was wonderful. And after I broke two or three of them, this glass sliding door opens, and my father comes out and he asks, "Gary, do you know anything about these broken bottles on the porch?" And I said, "No." He said, "Are you sure?" I said, "Yeah, I'm sure." He said, "You mean you didn't break those bottles?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Your mother is in the house crying because she said that her little boy couldn't tell a lie. And just to let you know, I'm going to save your life because right now I think she'd beat the tar out of you. Learning that you could tell a lie." Anyway, I wrote that story and I established myself as a liar early on. So take what you like from this speech and leave the rest and understand who the source is. I've been blind since birth, and I had cataracts and glaucoma and a dead optic nerve from being born 3 months too early. So when it came to blindness, I really checked all of the boxes, so to speak. I am permanently and irreversibly blind, as the law would say. And I guess the good thing about that is that aging hasn't changed a thing for me. My vision has remained absolutely stable. When I grew up, I had a lot of conflicting expectations. And a lot of conflicting messages. One was, you can do anything that you want. Because you're smart and you're motivated, and that's all great. But of course, you are blind. And that meant that there were a lot of things that I supposedly couldn't do. I had few role models who were blind because, in part, my folks thought that I would never grow up to be blind. They thought that I would grow up to be sighted because, of course, either God would take care of it by way of a miracle for which many of my family members prayed, or he would take care of it indirectly through science, because any nation that could put a man on the moon could certainly cure blindness in their child. And part of what that meant for me was that I grew up hoping that I would be sighted and being a little bit afraid about being blind. And it wasn't that I had a bad childhood. I had a great childhood. I had a Shetland pony and then a horse. I had a bicycle that I rode. I even got a motorcycle by twisting my dad's arm when he brought home motorcycles for my younger brothers, and there wasn't one there for me. And he asked, do you really think you can do this? And I said, yes, I really do think I can do it. And he said, well, we've kind of always let you be the judge of what you could and couldn't do. And so he bought me a motorcycle. And it was great, except that one of the problems with the motorcycle is its motor made enough noise that it was great for echolocation, but it was terrible for hearing other things off in the not so great distance. Oh, my cell phone is driving me crazy. I apologize for that. I'm going to, it wasn't so great for my brothers who were riding in front of me and decided to stop without telling me that they were going to stop. One of the reasons that I was afraid to grow up blind was that everybody in my family who did anything of value drove something. Driving was the key. My father worked in construction, and so he ran what they call heavy excavating equipment. He would dig a basement. He would dig a trench. He would haul away dirt. Even when he graduated to being a builder, the major part of his work as a contractor was to drive around and look at the houses that people were building for him. And I couldn't figure out where I would fit in that world if being successful meant that you had to grow up and you had to drive something. Now, I got to do plenty of work as a kid. And I had lots of interactions with my brothers and sisters. By being the oldest, I was able to modify the games we played, like football and baseball. I was expected to help put up hay in the hay field. We lived on a farm for a good bit of my childhood. And my job was to throw the bales up on a moving truck. And of course, you could tell where the truck was by sound. Finding the bales was a little more difficult. The truck would kind of orient itself so that the bales would appear in my path. And so I would trip over them, grab them up, and throw them up to my waiting brothers who would stack the hay. And one of my family members angrily asked my father one day, if you're going to make your blind kid put up hay, why don't you let him at least stay on the truck and stack the hay instead of making him find the bales that way? And my father replied, he's the oldest, he's the tallest, he's the strongest. When his brothers get to where they can throw hay like he does, maybe I'll let him be on the truck and he can stack like you think would be better for him. I did that work. I cleaned bricks for a while, which is taking old bricks from buildings and rehabilitating them by knocking off the mortar so they can be used again. And I worked in a sheltered workshop for a while. I started out by putting washers on bolts and eventually came to put China markers together and then ballpoint pens. And after working in the sheltered shop for a while, I persuaded myself that I was going to go to college because the manufacturing job didn't pay all that much. And I found that the only way I could maneuver throughout the workday was to spend that time in daydreaming. And I wanted to do more than just daydream. So I went off to college. You know, that's a little bit of biography. Let me move to why we're here, because I think that's what a banquet speech should really be about. I think for some of us, the reason we're here is selfish. We needed something that the NFB could give to us. In my own case, as a college student, I needed role models. I needed to learn study techniques from blind people. I needed help advocating with rehab for some piece of equipment or other, or to make sure that they would pay for my books. When I graduated from college, I became a computer programmer, and I needed technological advancements to stay employed. As my colleagues got things easily, I had to go and figure out ways to modify my techniques or hope that the software industry for assistive technology would come along. So I needed a cadre of people who knew a lot about screen readers. I needed an entree to Microsoft and a way to talk with them that was meaningful about the shortcomings in Windows that kept me from being efficient. I needed an in with Freedom Scientific, the maker of JAWS, so that they could make their program more responsive to the kinds of programming jobs that I was doing. But mostly I needed people to tell me that I could stay in my field, even as that field changed. And not only did they tell me that through words, but they told me that because they showed me other people who worked in my field who were keeping their jobs, and they weren't falling apart like I was sometimes tempted to do. A friend of mine who worked with me in the programming field said that he was jealous of me, and I asked him why, because we had roughly equivalent jobs. And he said, you know, I'm not really very motivated by writing programs and screens and generating reports for data entry. He said, I do it just to make a living. But you have something a little extra special. You have the Federation work you do. And so not only do you do all of the stuff that I do, but you have something that may make some impact on changing the world. And I thought that was interesting, that somebody would actually be jealous of the fact that I had a cause larger than myself. That's been a real benefit to me. Of course, I needed much more than all of this. I didn't get everything that I needed from the NFB. You don't get all of the spiritual enrichment that you need from the NFB. You got to get things elsewhere. This is not a one-stop shop for everything that you need in life. But I think that the NFB helped me earn places in the community that I would not have had the desire or the confidence to go after without it. You know, the NFB is real, but it is more real when you take it seriously. It's more substantial when you're involved in it. The NFB, for some people, can be a take it or leave it thing, but the better able we are to help and be a part of it, the more it will get done. I had a loved one who was an alcoholic, and she introduced me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the speakers who had a popular cassette that got distributed around was named Father Martin. And Father Martin would tell the story about the difference between rehabilitation centers for alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, you know, in some ways, the rehabilitation centers were like fancy cruise ships. You went there and you were taken care of and you were fed really well and you had no need that went unmet, except maybe the need for alcohol. And he said, and you come out and you realize that here's this group that they're encouraging you to join, which is Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's not a cruise ship at all. It's a canoe, because if it's going to work, you've got to go get in and you've got to paddle. And the harder you paddle, the more substantial that canoe is, the more real it is, and the more change it makes in your life. And I think that although we don't follow a 12-step program in the NFB, that's also true about the NFB. The more you do, the more real it is, the more work it does, and the more it justifies what you put into it. I've been really lucky in my life. I came into the NFB when it was difficult to rent an apartment because people would tell you, I don't have anything on the first floor, or I'm afraid to rent to you because I think that if people realize I'm renting to a blind person, my insurance will go up. So I witnessed the passage of the Model White Cane Law in the state of Missouri. And at the time, I was using a guide dog. And not only did I get recognized as somebody pushing for the passage of the Model White Cane Law, but my guide dog got recognized as an honorary page for a day. That is a job that's usually given to humans. I was around to see our insurance commissioner pass the law or pass the regulation that Michael Hinkson was talking about earlier that said, if you don't have a good reason to discriminate against me on the basis of
we don't have
tables.
No reason to discriminate against them.
I'm getting a little competition here. If you don't have actuarial statistics to show that blind people are more accident prone, then you've got to sell them life insurance on the same basis of as other people. If you can't show that they have a health condition that impacts how likely it is they're going to go to the hospital, you got to do that kind of thing. I was here to witness the passage of a Braille bill, a parental rights bill that says that you can't use disability in determining whether or not a person will make a good parent. You know, I think that for all of those things that I'm proud of, our job today is even more crucial than all of the things that I've been a part of. You see, if we want to be integrated with the sighted, I think we have to address real barriers. Now, some of them are attitudinal. One of the biggest attitudinal problems I think we face is I shouldn't have to work this hard because sighted people don't have to work this hard. Well, what does that really mean? I don't know what it means to make such a statement like that. What does it mean that I shouldn't have to work that hard? Maybe Donald Trump shouldn't have more money than I have. Maybe Jeff Bezos shouldn't have more money than he knows what to do with while other people starve. But what does shouldn't really mean? If we let shouldn't stand between us and what we want to do, we're going to lose. So what are the physical barriers? We can't let grocery stores become less accessible because of kiosks that we can't use to check ourselves out. We can't let doctor's offices become harder to access because they hand us an iPad and want us to check ourselves in, and that iPad doesn't talk, or if it does talk, they don't know how to make it talk, and the program isn't accessible. We can't stand by and watch as home appliances become ever more difficult to use. Stoves and ovens that we can't label, thermostats we can't set. We can't have big box stores being our enemy. We need them to be our friend. We need to be able to go and buy things that other people buy and bring them home and with some slight modification, if any, use them. Everything from, I would start with exercise equipment, medical equipment, the things we talked about this morning in the National Report. I think we have to save our blind elementary and secondary students from a bad educational outcome that is far too often what they get, because we've managed to integrate them in the environment so that they go to school with their brothers and sister in their neighborhood, but they don't get educational integration, which really is a big part of why people go to school for education. I think we have to protect the Americans with Disabilities Act, because for all that's said about it, it's actually a pretty weak act. It needs strengthening, and yet the efforts that we see in Congress are to weaken it. I think accessibility must become an agreed-upon standard, not just a nice thing to do, or we're going to fall behind. I don't know about you, but I love the life that I live. And I don't want to slide backward. And I don't want to say to the next generation, I'm sorry, you are less well off than I am because I didn't work on the problems that I clearly saw ahead of us. I chose to do something else. You know, all of us, I'm not unique in this, want to leave the world a better place than we found it. And for me, the NFB is one way to do that. So what do I do? And more importantly, what can you do? Well, I sell candy and I do other fundraisers because I know that without money, the NFB lacks a vital tool to bring about real change. You can have lots of carpenters, but if they don't have hammers and nails and screwdrivers and wrenches and other things, not very much gets done. So what else do? Well, I call people to see how they feel, what they need, and what they want to give to help themselves and others through our organization. When we have a picnic, I bring food. I don't know how good it is, but it's food. I help serve the food, and I eat my fair share of the food. I call legislators when we get the call that asks that we write or call them, because I think that the legislative issues that I outlined this morning are worth working for. I visit service clubs and I give presentations saying that when the blind lead the blind, we make progress. We don't fall into a ditch. I seek out radio shows and tell people that essentially we are blind, but we are just like you. Some of you may recognize that that was a message that was contained in some of the PSAs that were played frequently when I came into the Federation. But, you know, as important as what I do individually is, it's not about me. I play as part of a team because the I is not nearly as important as the us. Sometimes I'm called on to lead, but most of the time these days, I'm asked to follow, to help, to work behind the scenes, to make other people look good. And I've gotten my fair share of recognition for my name. So help somebody else to grow. Mark Maurer helped me write my first article for the Braille Monitor, and he never uttered a word about it because he wasn't interested in building himself as much as he was interested in building me. I think that everything we do makes a difference. Setting up chairs and tables at a meeting makes a difference to those who don't believe that they can do that simple task. You know, Dr. Jernigan gave a speech that I really love. It's one that inspires and scares me at the same time. The speech was entitled, "That's How It Is at the Top of the Stairs." And essentially, the thesis of the speech was this: there's nothing we can't do if we work together. The only thing that can stop us is when we decide to stop trying, when we decide that things are good enough, that we've come close enough to the top of the stairs that it's okay to just be where we are. We have enough income to get by. Nobody's discriminating against us when we go out for housing. Our travel skills are good enough to get us to where we want to go. Sure, there are more things we might like, but we have better things to do than go to a chapter meeting or an affiliate convention. We have better things to do than write about the legislation or take work home with us. Well, I'm inspired because I think that we can make things better. And who more than us should want to make things better, not only for blind people, but for everybody in America? I really do believe that. I believe that every bit of progress we make not only benefits us, but every American. And in these times of division and a lack of unity, I think everybody can get behind that. You know, we often talk about choice. And in the NFB, we have choice in spades. No army is going to compel us to do the work of the NFB. We get to decide whether or not it's important. And I think that's a wonderful thing, because too often we're made to do things that we don't want to do, but what we want to do ends up being really special. I want to end by saying thank you to you folks. You took a scared kid who wondered if he would have value in society. You told him he could do things that he didn't think he could do. You gave him help along the way. You pushed him when he was unfocused. And you let him live the life that he dreamed about but feared would never be his. You see, you've helped create something of a miracle for me. I have a wonderful wife, and she's more than my friend and more than my lover. She completes me, and we together have four wonderful children, four tremendous grandchildren. We have good jobs. We have a nice house. We have good books to read, and we're blessed with many people who care about us. We were never made more aware of that than when the news got out that we contracted COVID, and people were calling us very frequently to find out how we were doing. And our favorite statement was, we guess we're doing all right because we're not in the hospital and we're not in the graveyard. You know, nobody can get all of this from the world and not want to give back. And that's why we're here tonight to give back through the National Federation of the Blind. Thank you for listening. Thank you for caring. And thank you for everything that you have done and will do to build our National Federation of the Blind and make some small part of the world just a little bit better. Thanks.
Thanks, Gary.